I'm here today on my podcast, Different Matters, with the chairman of the In New Zealand Initiative, Roger Partridge. Roger, thanks for coming.
Hi, Damien. Nice to have you. Nice of you to have
me. we're here talking about your recent report for the initiative dealing with judicial activism by the Supreme Court. Before we start to delve into that, at the very heart of this, we need to paint a picture. And the picture, I think, really starts with the common law. So what is the common law and how does it differ from legislation?
Right. Well, I'd have started with parliamentary sovereignty, but let's come back to that. Sources of law in New Zealand, there are three. The laws made by Parliament, so statutes, as they're known, or acts, as they're known. The judge-made law, so these are the principles the judges have laid down in deciding cases between particular litigants over centuries. So, for example, it was judges who first decided what sort of contracts would be enforced. When you promise to meet your friend at the theatre and you don't show up, that's not an enforceable contract. So we needed to work out what sort of promises were enforceable. That aspect of the common law has since been codified in statutes, but there's a whole series of common law principles, known, many of them known as torts, so the tort of defamation, tort of trespass to property, so civil wrongs. So those common law principles and the causes of action that they give rise to have emerged over many, many centuries in the English common law. And embodied within them, you can discern principles. And our courts continue to apply those principles to novel situations as they turn up. So, for example, in the case of contract law, the law had to work out when was an offer accepted. When you're face-to-face with somebody, it's instantaneous. When you post a letter, is an offer to sell something accepted when you post the letter or when it's received? When there's a text, so or an email. So the courts develop and apply those principles to new situations as they show up. Part of the common law method has traditionally been respect for precedent, so previous decisions, and incremental development. And those two elements are critical to what lawyers call the rule of law.
And what was the third?
The third source, I'll come back to the rule of law, shall I, as well as to parliamentary sovereignty. The third source is custom. So long as custom meets certain requirements, it can be given the force of law.
An example being?
Well, actually, a modern and contemporary, well, modern in the last 100 or so years. The common law has recognised tikanga custom in certain circumstances. For example, until the Supreme Court's decision in Ellis, the leading case was Loseby, and the court there...
That was back in 1908.
Court there recognised that the custom of the tribe collectively paying the funeral costs of a deceased was enforceable. Because it was certain, it was long-standing, it had all the requirements necessary to be a custom that could be enforced by the court. So three sources of law: statute, judge-made law, and custom.
Is there a statute on defamation?
There is now, but defamation was one of the torts.
But the example I often like to give is receivership. So receivership is something that grew organically and was then codified. Okay, so that's a common law. So let's talk. Well, you mentioned the other issues. So let's talk about the rule of law.
So the rule of law has a traditional meaning and a more modern one. Traditionally, it refers to the formal aspects that laws have to be regarded as laws. The most important is that they're consistently applied. That the rules are predictable. That they're available so that ordinary people can find out what the law is, that there's access to justice to determine legal issues.
So the contrast is that you have the rule of law as separate from the rule of man, I guess, would be the common So,
well, yes, it's a term that has many shades of meaning, but to most lawyers, at the very least, it means the formal characteristics that laws must have to be recognised as laws rather than just as the arbitrary exercise of power.
Okay.
Now, and key in that, impartially applied and consistent and predictable. And the reason why consistent and predictable is so important is that people need to know what the law is so that they can organise their affairs. And that's true for people and for businesses as well.
Now, we come to parliamentary sovereignty. So let's talk what parliamentary sovereignty is, and then maybe a little bit of history as to why we have it and how it works in a situation where we don't have a constitution.
Well, we do have a constitution. We've just got an unwritten constitution. But parliamentary sovereignty needs to be considered in the context of the three branches of government. There's Parliament,
mm-hmm.
the elected representatives of voters, the executive, which is the government of the day, Prime Minister and Cabinet, controlling the bureaucracy, exercising delegated power. So Parliament, the executive, and the courts. And one way of thinking about the three different roles is that Parliament makes laws forward-looking and of general application.
Mm-hmm.
The executive implements the laws, and the judiciary adjudicates, interprets and applies the laws to particular disputes between litigants. Now, that's because we've heard about the common law, that's not the judiciary's only role. They have a role in this judge-made law, the common law.
Mm-hmm.
But primarily the role of the judges is backwards-looking. So Parliament forwards-looking, making the laws for the future, general application, the executive executing them in the present, and judges primarily looking backwards at what the law was at the time a dispute arose and applying that law to the facts and making a decision between particular litigants.
So why in New Zealand? So a lot of people will be thinking, okay, we're very familiar with the United States. The United States has a constitution. We don't have, okay, you said we do have a constitution, but we don't have a constitution in the sense of a single written document like the Americans or the Australians do. So come back a step, how did parliamentary sovereignty arise? Why do we have parliamentary sovereignty? Where did that come from?
Well, it goes back to revolution in the UK and successively in the 13th and 17th centuries. Yes.
So 1688 is the traditional date upon which the Glorious Revolution.
Yes. I suppose the short answer is the concept of parliamentary sovereignty derives from England and is historic.
And it comes out of a conflict between the king, the sovereign, and Parliament.
Correct.
So these two sources of power had been grappling with each other,
let's say time immemorial.
Time immemorial, right? I was just trying to think with the Magna Carta, but that wasn't really, that was kind of barons, which were arguably a proto-parliament. In the middle of that process, we have the judiciary kind of emerging. When I interviewed Lord Hannan, I asked him where did the judges come from, and he didn't have an answer, and I can't seem to find out. They just seem to grow organically from the Anglo-Saxon field. But one of the constraints, and this is because I want to push back a little bit on the idea of why we should have parliamentary sovereignty, but one of the more interesting aspects when you have a look back and you have a look at the reign of King Charles I, who of course lost his head, when he had his 11-year rule of absolute power, he was constrained in a number of ways. And one of the ways he was constrained is he was unable to raise additional money because nobody would give him the money because he didn't have the laws to back it up, which I find kind of remarkable that his power was constrained. And then he had this crazy idea that he found some piece of ship legislation that he could raise money for people who lived nearby the sea and whatever. And he ran it past the judiciary, and it was a close-run thing. The judiciary at the time was quite prepared to stand up to the king and push back. Now, ultimately, parliamentary sovereignty was resolved pretty clearly when Parliament cut his head off. So that's where we... And then in the 1688, we have Parliament being unhappy with the Catholic king, or because he had a child. And so Parliament took power unto themselves. It wasn't necessarily a considered process. There was no great hooey where people sat down and decided this is what we should do. It grew organically, and we've had, I guess, parliamentary sovereignty unchallenged since 1688. The Americans and the Australians went down a different path. They wrote a written constitution. So the question then becomes, is our system necessarily a better one? We don't have a written a constitution. This arguments will come about what Lord Hoffman and his views on should the common law be the constitution. But let's just think about in our current setting, we have parliamentary sovereignty. Is that the best system? Why are you here defending parliamentary sovereignty as opposed to the other forms that we could argue for?
Well, I suppose at one level I'm defending parliamentary sovereignty because that's our system of government.
You are a classic small C conservative.
In this report, that's why I'm defending. I've found I've become a small C conservative more and more.
It's a function of age, Roger. The same thing happens to me.
Perhaps even wisdom in your case, at least.
Very generous.
Comes from having had your ideas shot down often enough that it leads to your position changing. So I'm defending it in the report because it is our system.
Yes.
And we're getting some. The system is showing some faults,
mm-hmm.
And there are some red flashing lights. There are components within the system not working as our system is designed to work and should be working. And so the report, in a sense, is an intervention and an instruction manual to Parliament on how to get the system working. But coming back to parliamentary sovereignty, why is it a good thing rather than just being the thing we've got?
Yes.
Is that it's proved enduring. It's proved also to be a system that has promoted human flourishing. It's also, if you look back at over the history of liberal democracy over several hundred years, it's also been remarkably good at protecting minority rights. People talk about the tyranny of a majority.
Yes.
But our system of government has been, I think if you look at and compare democracies like ours with just about any other countries in the world, you'll find that they've been remarkably good at protecting individual rights and minority rights, whether it's voting for women, in New Zealand's case, the integration of the indigenous Maori population by providing them with specific voting rights in the mid-1800s. Or ensuring they had voting rights in the mid-1800s, 1867. We perhaps were a bit slow to the party on homosexual law reform in mm-hmm. the 1980s. We were relatively fast on same-sex marriage. I think legislation passed under a conservative small-c government. Our system of government has proved remarkably good for human flourishing and remarkably good for the protection of minority rights. And if we zero in on the big issue for New Zealand with minority rights, it was Parliament that introduced the Treaty of Waitangi settlement process with cross-party support for decades. To redress wrongs from the past. So I think the main basis upon which parliamentary sovereignty should be evaluated is how good a system of government it's been compared with everything else.
Okay, so let's look at the counterfactual. So the counterfactual is coming The argument, was it common law constitutionalism, I think is the term that you and is it Jack Hodder use?
Well, that's one counterfactual. Perhaps a more immediate counterfactual is having a written constitution. That would be the most adjacent system of constitutional government to ours. So that a written constitution like Australia or Canada or the US or even Germany, continental countries like Germany. I think one reason why we should be cautious about having a written constitution is that it is a less, in a sense, it's a less, it leads to a less accountable, it leads to a less accountable judicial system. So if you make judges, if you give judges power to sit above parliament, and they end up making big social policy decisions in the name of upholding the constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike legislatures, they're not accountable to voters for those decisions. So, for example, the Canadian Supreme Court has invented out of the right to life in the Canadian Constitution a right to medically assisted euthanasia. Now, I'm in favour of medically assisted euthanasia, go figure how that follows. And many jurists in Canada are scratching their heads.
So you end up
with a system where if you've got a court sitting above parliament, it lacks three important characteristics. Well, at least two, and I'll see if there's a third. Firstly, it lacks democratic accountability. So yes, it can make big social policy decisions without being accountable to the people. Unlike parliamentarians, if they get things wrong, they get thrown out.
Yep.
And our judges don't. Secondly, judges lack the fact-finding tools that parliament has to work out whether a big social policy shift is a good idea. If you think about the parliamentary process before a big social policy change, a topic normally goes off to the Law Commission and gets studied for 2 or 3 years. And then it gets debated at various stages, and then there's a detailed submission-making process. And then you get the law, and then if people don't like it, they change the government and the law can be changed. If you've got judges sitting above the courts, you don't have either of those two. And a third disability that judges have, which makes them inferior to parliament for making big social policy decisions, is that disputes come to the courts in particular circumstances. So they're dealing with the facts of the case before them.
Yes.
And that can colour their view of what the right outcome is. And I think that's absolutely what happened in Fitzgerald, which is an unquestionably shocking decision.
So just give it...
We'll come back. It's a three strikes case. I'm sure
we'll come back to it.
Unquestionably unjust decision, but an unquestionably shocking judgment. So the problem for the courts is they're dealing with disputes in particular circumstances. So they don't have quite...
It's also random.
Well, that's a corollary of it. So they're not democratically accountable, unlike mm-hmm. parliamentarians. So if they stuff up, it's very hard to change what they've decided, and you can't throw them out. They lack the resources and the tools.
The fact-finding
tools. And disputes come to them randomly with particular facts that will colour their thinking, inevitably, because our thinking is always coloured by the stories before us. And frankly, also with particular... counsel representing the parties. You might have one very, very slick one and not so good, and that might affect their assessment of the merits of the argument. So I think I now think I didn't. I was certainly If you'd asked me 20 years ago, I would have been fully in favour of a written constitution. I now think a written constitution is less desirable than the system of government constitutional arrangements we have. And so that then brings us to your question about common law constitutionalism. And, yes. And shall I have a go at explaining what that mean, what you mean by that, or yes, would you
I
like
think,
to?
No, I think it's your report, so yeah. Tell us what
Well, I don't define, I touch on it, I think, or judicial supremacy. This is the idea that the judges sit above Parliament even without a written constitution and have the ability, they have a common law right that comes out of the same sort of milieu as the right to enforce contracts or to require people to pay damages if they've injured somebody or damaged their property. That deep within the common law lies a notion that the judges are sitting over the top of Parliament. Now,
I'll touch on that for a sec. So my understanding of the common law was where there was no legislation, there was a vacuum, and so the two parties come to court and the judge needs to make a determination, and they're not saying, here we have a contract law piece of legislation, I'm going to apply that legislation to this dispute. In the situation where there was no legislation, then the judges need to look at the facts in the absence of legislation, and that's where that was part of what drove common law.
Right. Yes. From decided cases, principles emerged, and then generally now, the common law method is to identify those principles from what lawyers call precedents, decided cases.
Yes.
Applying the most authoritative one from the highest level of court that's decided the matter, and then apply that to the apply that to the facts. And from time to time, judges will find out that the principles haven't quite been fleshed out in a particular circumstance. Now, I should say that's categorically not the common law method our Supreme Court is now following, and that's a big part of the report. The traditional common law method is incremental development, drawing on the principles of the common law, the existing principles of the common law.
And you describe as ambulatory?
Well, that's a different issue. So to statutory interpretation. No, in relation to the common law, rather than this drawing the principles out of the common law, applying precedents, so decided cases, ensuring that the law is consistent and predictable because there are reams of textbooks setting out what the common law rules are.
Yes.
Our current judges believe that have adopted a radically new common law method, which is to develop the common law to reflect their views of society's changing values. So they're taking this hundreds of years old common law and taking it on a journey. Now, that of course is subject to the same problems that I identified with having judges supreme in relation to either common law supremacy or supremacy of the sort I described in relation to the Canadian Supreme Court, that they don't have the tools to discern what society's changing values are.
But in the circumstances where there is, because I think there's perhaps two separate issues, where there is no guiding legislation necessarily, and the judges are having to make a determination on common law precedent, and the last precedent was in 1950, society and culture has moved on, they are now searching for a new common law truth or a common law truth. That in itself shouldn't be that controversial.
Not if it's drawing on the principles of the body of law that we've inherited from England by legislation. It was Parliament that introduced the common law to New Zealand.
Yes.
In 1852, and then it was reaffirmed in the Imperial Laws Act, remarkably recently, actually, in 1988, which seems...
it does seem weird, but there you go.
Far too well into my lifetime for the word imperial still to be used.
I like the fact that there are sections of the Magna Carta that it's still active in New Zealand legislation.
Yeah, Yeah.
But anyway, go on.
Yes, from time to time a litigant will go to the court and say, look, the existing common law rules don't apply here, I don't have a cause of action. And the court will either strike it out or it'll say, you know, there is no legal right recognised by the common law, or it'll say, that's interesting. The common law recognises liability here, here and here in three very adjacent areas. You can generalise from the principles that are applied there to work out that there should also be liability here, in which case the claim will proceed.
Okay.
But generally, it's the common law method involves drawing on the principles of the common law, not taking it on a journey.
So, because I think there's maybe a reference to what's happening in Smith and Fonterra, but before we get down to that, the counter that has been put forward by the likes of Lord Hoffman. So Lord Hoffman's view, if I'm understanding your work and Jack Hodder's work, is that parliamentary sovereignty means Parliament can, if it chooses to, legislate to override fundamental principles of human rights. But if it does it must be explicit and it must be really clear about what it's doing. In the absence of expressed language, the courts, according to Hoffman, can presume that basic rights prevail where there is ambiguity, or I think you used the term tiebreaker. And I'm going to quote Hoffman. In this way, the courts of the United Kingdom, though acknowledging the sovereignty of Parliament, imply principles of constitutionality little different from those who exist in countries where the power of the legislative is expressly limited by a constitutional document. So what he appears to be saying is that there is a law of the land, there is a common law that in some sense acts as a constitution that can and should constrain Parliament, and this Parliament has been really clear in what it's doing.
Yes, so on that, I think it was an unquestionably radical statement of Hoffman's and remarkably dismissive of the democratic process.
So he said this in 2000.
Yes.
So it's a relatively...
Yes. So I think it was unquestionably radical, and it encouraged the UK Supreme Court was more overreaching as a result of Hoffman's observations than our Supreme Court had been even under Chief Justice Elias. But let's back up a little bit. The courts have always used... So we're dealing here not with the common law so much as the court's approach to interpreting statutes. So we're not talking about judge-made law here, but we're talking about the approach that the judges have developed within guidelines set by Parliament for interpreting acts of Parliament.
But aren't they, maybe I'm misreading something, aren't they that they are drawing on the principles that come from common law?
Well, the courts have applied, yes, the courts have applied principles to work out how to interpret ambiguous legislation. So we're not here dealing, and so they're common law principles, but that's a different kind of common law principle than the one that said contracts are enforceable.
Yes.
So the courts have got two jobs, or two primary sources of law. I mentioned custom, but ignoring that for the moment, there's acts of Parliament,
mm-hmm.
and there's the common law.
Yep.
Common law is judge-made law. Statute law or acts of Parliament are made by Parliament.
Yep.
But they have to be interpreted.
Yes.
And the guidelines the courts follow in interpreting acts of Parliament are primarily laid down by Parliament. So the principal guideline currently is in New Zealand, it's in section 10.1 of the Legislation Act, appropriately named, yes. Act 2019, and it directs that the courts that the meaning of legislation must be ascertained from its text and in the light of its purpose and context. So that's work out. You must interpret our words having regard to the context in which we passed the legislation and what we obviously intended to do. Because of the nature of human language, there's always uncertainty in the meaning mm-hmm. of words used. And so the courts can consider Parliament's obvious intent and the context in which the legislation was passed. So what does the court do when there's ambiguity and they could go one way or the other? They're not quite sure what a clause means. And it's here that the courts have developed their own presumptions with Parliament's tacit approval, that they'll assume Parliament, if there's ambiguity, that Parliament didn't intend the law to apply retrospectively, so to things that happened before the law was passed. They'll assume that when they gave search and seizure powers to the Serious Fraud Office or the Commerce Commission, they didn't intend those powers to be able to seize legally privileged documents, so legal advice. But those presumptions have historically been used as tiebreakers. If there's uncertainty, if it's not clear what Parliament means, then we'll use these common law presumptions to help us work out Parliament's intent.
Well, the Bill of Rights gives them explicit authority to do that.
Yes. So in relation to legislation that impinges on rights protected by the Bill of Rights, like the freedom from discrimination, for example, on any one of a number of grounds, including age, we might come to that.
A sensitive issue for both of us, Roger.
Exactly. So in the case of legislation that impinges on a right protected by the Bill of Rights, Parliament has given the courts explicit permission that when that where possible, it should adopt a meaning of legislation, of some act that impinges on the Bill of Rights. Where possible, it should adopt a meaning that is consistent with the rights protected under the Bill of Rights. So that has definitely given the courts permission to change the ordinary meaning of Parliament's words.
And do we have an example where they have done that?
Yes, many examples. They use that in Fitzgerald.
So let's talk about Fitzgerald.
Yes. But just before we go, but what Lord Hoffman's talking about is not it, with that statement of what he means by the principle of legality.
Yes.
Is the courts treating the presumptions or the principle of legality as a presumption that trumps, that doesn't need an ambiguity, that trumps Parliament's words if they impinge on what the court regards as fundamental rights. And that might be rights protected by the Bill of Rights, or it might be other rights.
Right, okay. So
what Lord Hoffman has done there, and our courts now followed that, our Supreme Court has now followed that, what Lord Hoffman's suggesting there is that under the guise of interpretation, the courts can use the principle of legality to trump the words used by Parliament, even if there isn't an ambiguity. And that is, without doubt, a radical proposition.
So,
in the context of parliamentary sovereignty.
Maybe you and I are reading Hoffman slightly differently, but because when I read the preamble to that quote, he did say that if Parliament can legislate to override fundamental principles of human rights, but it must do so explicitly, and in the absence of express language, then courts can prevail. So maybe I've misread that.
What he's saying is the courts will require you to refer to the specific right. And we'll see an example of that in action in Fitzgerald.
All right. So
he's saying I'm telling you, Parliament, as the Supreme Court,
yeah,
if you want to legislate against right X, you must explicitly say so.
Right.
Whereas okay. Parliament's instructions to the courts is that you must interpret legislation, our words, having regard to our purpose and in light of the statutory purpose and in light of the context. Parliament, Hoffman's granting to the courts greater license than the court has directed the courts, than the parliament has directed the courts in its guidelines to the courts on how to interpret.
And what? And so the inference is that there is an underlying law of the land, rights, whatever, that are that in a sense parliament can't or shouldn't violate. And I have some sympathy for that. If parliament was to pass a law that was morally unconscionable,
there would be a revolution. That's the outcome in our
not necessarily though, because I guess we do. You look at the prescription against homosexuality and even now on the issue of marijuana, I think many people believe the prohibition against marijuana to be a fundamentally stupid law, and that it is we are collectively ignoring it in the same way as we collectively turned a blind eye to homosexuality. There is a sense that Parliament is constrained, even though Parliament can pass a law, it must operate inside the environment of the population that it is governing. And if it passes a law that is an anathema to its population, it's going to find it very difficult to enforce it. But we're getting...
Just before we leave that point, you've got to work out what's the lesser of two evils.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's... Maybe people talk about the tyranny of the majority, but we've had a... The history of our parliament, certainly over the last, well, most of my lifetime, is of being a parliament that is mostly rights respecting, and has worked pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And you can point to some things that we can be very proud of, including the treaty settlement process. Giving the power to the courts to overrule the will of voters,
mm-hmm,
is also dangerous because, for the reasons I noted earlier, to whom are the judges accountable?
Yeah.
If we don't like what they've decided, how can we kick them out? By what tools do they determine the best social policy outcomes? They're not fact-finding institutions.
You must have some sympathy for the judges, though. I mean, if you are sitting there in the Supreme Court and you look across Lambton Quay at the cattle of a people sitting in Parliament, I am not surprised that they reserve to themselves the philosopher king rights. But I understand.
Well, I think amongst certain elites in New Zealand, there is it's become fashionable to have disdain for Parliament.
Yes, and Parliament has worked very hard to encourage it.
Well, at times it does, and at times Parliament's to blame for leaving too much for the courts to do,
yes,
unquestionably. But the counterfactual is worse. The counterfactual of an undemocratically accountable judicial elite making social policy decisions is very unlikely to be as robust as the system of parliamentary sovereignty that we have for all its flaws.
Mm-hmm.
And I started my article in Law News with the cautionary tale of the US Supreme Court. So the US Supreme Court's got the power to strike down legislation, mm-hmm, and it's got the power to be quite creative in its lawmaking. Well, it's exercised that power, whether it legitimately, yes, should do so. But while it's had a progressive majority, conservatives have riled against it, but progressives have been very happy with its activist approach. Now that it has a conservative majority, conservatives are very happy with its approach, and progressives are riling against an overreaching court. Better to have a court that stays in its lane. The outcome is that the US Supreme Court is held in very low regard.
Yes.
We've seen many instances of distorted legal reasoning, whether it's a Democrat, a progressive court, or a conservative court. We have a lack. There's a loss of faith in the impartiality of the Supreme Court. In fact, it's regarded as effectively as a political institution, and it's undermined the democratic legitimacy of the U.S. legal system. And my report is alerting us to the dangers of that approach. Our Supreme Court currently seems blind to the risks and intent on taking us down the same path. Anyway.
Maybe they want to be, because if you asked the average New Zealander, if there was such a thing, to name a Supreme Court judge, they would probably name American Supreme Court judges. The American Supreme Court judges are better known in New Zealand than our own Supreme Court judges. And in a way, I think that is a success.
I also think it's a success. It's exactly how you want it.
Yes.
You don't want the personality of the judge to be relevant to the judicial decision-making process. However, if you ask any legal practitioner now, it unquestionably is. And it's only a matter of time before that hits the attention of the ordinary voter. And at that point, our judicial system will have lost the respect and trust that we we have so much to benefit from it, maintaining.
Because it's interesting, 10 years ago, I would have struggled to name one or two Supreme Court judges. Now, I do know them because these political issues are
correct.
Cropping up to my... I'm active and involved in the space, but 10 years ago, I might have been able to name one. Let's just run through the specific examples that you and Hodda refer to. So let's talk about Fitzgerald. We've talked about it a couple of times. This is a really interesting case. So what happened?
So it's a case concerning what people know as the three strikes legislation, mm-hmm. passed by a national-led government that required the judiciary on a third strike offence. So the third time a defendant had been convicted of a qualifying offence, to impose the maximum sentence.
Yes,
and it's not a piece of legislation I particularly like, but it was unquestionably the prerogative of our democratically elected parliament to pass the three strikes legislation. Mr. Fitzgerald's third strike offence was a relatively low-level indecent assault.
He attempted to kiss a woman on the lips. And ended up kissing her on the cheek. It was unquestionably a crime. Pretty low. He had mental health issues. But it was... It beggars the mind that the police decided to prosecute him.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, they did.
Yes.
And it finds its way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Now, Parliament had passed Section 86D, provided that in these words, despite any other enactment, the High Court must sentence the offender to the maximum term of imprisonment prescribed for the offence. So the critical words there, despite any other enactment.
And that was presumably included the Bill of Rights Act.
Well, that became an issue in the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Now, of course it included the Bill of Rights Act. The Parliament's not blind to the Bill of Rights Act. And Parliament was also alive to the risk that of somebody like Mr. Fitzgerald coming up through the... slipping through the net. And so a process was put in place to ensure that low-level crimes didn't get prosecuted. Your statement.
Yeah.
And Mr. Fitzgerald, unfortunately, ended up being prosecuted, and he was awarded the maximum sentence.
Which was 7 years.
Yeah, which is an unappealing and to most of us would seem like an unjust outcome.
Mm-hmm.
But it was what Parliament had provided, despite any other enactment. And it's important to remember that in the Bill of Rights, there's a process that's now been in place since it was enacted in 1990, that any act that has the potential to breach the Bill of Rights must first go to the Attorney General, and advice must be given on whether it impinges the Bill of Rights and whether the impingement is fair and reasonable. So the legislation had been through that process. I think it's fair to say there was no doubt what Parliament intended. It intended the outcome. It didn't have Mr. Fitzgerald in mind. I think it's expected that he would have been
dealt with
in the safety net, not prosecuted. But the court's job is to have regard to interpret Parliament's words and apply them, having regard to Parliament's intent, discern purpose, and in the context of the legislation. The Section 6 of the Bill of Rights is the one that says if a right impinges a Bill of Rights, a right protected by the Bill of Rights, the court should apply a rights consistent interpretation if it can. So if there's one that's available, it should apply that.
Which is what they did here.
It was accepted that the sentence was manifestly unjust, so it breached the Bill of Rights. And it's important for listeners to know the Bill of Rights is just ordinary legislation. It doesn't override other legislation.
So this is our Bill of Rights, not this the is our 1688 Bill of Rights. Ones.
But the court decided to interpret the words. Well, now there was a discussion about, well, how much license have we got to interpret our way around this? And until Fitzgerald, our Supreme Court, the Elias Supreme Court, in a case called Hanson in 2006, said, we've got a bit of license under Section 6, but we can't impose an unreasonable interpretation because that's not interpreting, that's rewriting. Mm-hmm. And the Chief Justice, in her judgment in this court, in this case, in Fitzgerald, said the word reasonable is not in Section 6, so I don't think we should any longer feel constrained by that. And they interpreted Section 6. I'm going to read this out. They interpreted Section 86D, the three strikes provision, as if it had the following words written into it. And I'm able to do that because it was a very strong dissenting judgment from Justice Willie Young.
Was it? What? I love the dissent.
Yeah. So he says that what the majority has done in deciding they can interpret their way around it is read the words despite any other enactment as having a qualification, open brackets, but not including the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act 1990. And then continue with the section. If on any occasion an offender is convicted of one or more stage three offences other than murder, the High Court must sentence the offender to the maximum term of imprisonment prescribed for each of the offence, and then adding these words on, but must not do so if this would result in disproportionately severe punishment under Section 9 of the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act. Now, Parliament in Fitzgerald unquestionably knew about the Bill of Rights Act. It enacted a clause that was not ambiguous. There was no wriggle room. In fact, Young said that the language used by Parliament admitted of no ifs, buts, or maybes. And he said that he sees this adoption of the broader definition as statutory revision, not interpretation. Now, okay, you say, well, it got a just outcome for Mr. Fitzgerald, didn't it? And it's hard not to agree with that. But at what cost is the question? It's at the cost of our courts adopting a new approach to statutory interpretation, which allows them to, a corollary of not requiring a reasonable interpretation, it allows them to adopt an unreasonable interpretation of Parliament's words. And that is revolutionary, because Parliament is supreme. Parliament created the Supreme Court. In doing so in 2003, the Supreme Court Act said, nothing in this act shall change our commitment to the sovereignty of Parliament and the rule of law.
But they didn't define the rule of law.
They didn't define the rule of law, and that's one of the remedies I'm suggesting. So what we've got here is a court subverting the intention of Parliament,
willfully so,
and willfully so, and that's the view of the
most senior at the time of the justices on the Supreme Court, Justice Willie Young.
Well, I mean, because he said, and I'll quote him, referring to the legislation, its purpose was to require sentences to be imposed which were necessarily going to be disproportionate, and sometimes significantly so, by reference to ordinary sentencing principles. So his view was that Parliament knew what they were doing. Maybe they shouldn't have done it, but the Supreme Court are putting themselves in the role of a philosopher king, effectively saying, and the means by which they used to circumvent Parliament's intention, I think they were creative, but they knew what they were doing. I want to jump to Smith and Fonterra, because you were talking about discovering new torts at an earlier point, and I think Smith and Fonterra is an interesting one. This was Mike Smith, a fairly controversial Dunedin arborist, who Ngāpuhi Elder, who took it upon himself to sue a large number of corporate entities for climate change. The case was struck out by the High Court and the Court of Appeal. The Supreme Court heard the case and then did its own thing.
Well, his claim was that New Zealand's seven largest company, his claim is that New Zealand's seven largest companies are contributing, have damaged his land by contributing materially to climate change. In the Court of Appeal, the claim was struck out. I'm going to read. The court ruled that climate change could not be appropriately or adequately addressed by common law claims pursued through the courts. It was quintessentially a matter, the court said, that calls for a sophisticated regulatory response at a national level supported by international coordination. So that was the Court of Appeal.
Seems reasonable.
The Supreme Court felt no such restraint. They granted Mr. Smith leave to appeal. They only hear about 20 cases a year. So they selected this case as one they wanted to hear. And New Zealand's total emissions are only a tiny fraction of global emissions. Of course, you and I, we all contribute to them in an immaterial way. Every time we breathe out, let alone driving our cars. But New Zealand's total emissions are 17 parts in 10,000 to global emissions.
But what was the sin, in your view and mine, that they
Well, I'm not going to say it was a sin. The case is continuing, but it will see the courts engaged in. Firstly, we have a government-regulated emissions trading scheme, and we're parties to international treaties. But by permitting the claim to proceed to trial, the Supreme Court has inserted the courts in another quite politically charged role, and one which many will think is better suited to Parliament.
Did they create a tort that didn't exist before?
They didn't, no. They just said his claim was reasonably arguable, and that's still got to be tested when it goes to court.
Well, okay, all right. But the possibility that a tort pertaining to climate change, they did not rule it out.
They didn't rule it out, no. The Court of Appeal did. The Supreme Court has allowed Mr. Smith to take his claim forward.
And so the Supreme Court will presumably have the opportunity to rule on this a second time.
Well, it'll be the High Court first.
Court of Appeal and then the Supreme Court. Yeah. But we know the direction of travel, which is amazing. Let's also talk, running a bit of time, let's also talk about Edwards, the Marine and Coastal Area Act. So this is one that Parliament is actually legislating to correct.
Yes. So should we talk about that in the context of what the tools I'm suggesting? So we're recommending that there are five things Parliament should do to rein in an overreaching court. The first of them is targeted legislation. Parliament's supreme, it sits above the courts, and if it doesn't like the direction the court's taking the law, it shouldn't hesitate to legislate to bring the court back into line. It shouldn't have to in some of the cases we've been we analyse, but it shouldn't hesitate to where it needs to. And the Labor government did that in, I think it was 2021, in a case called D in the police, where they this is the Register of Sex Offenders, where the court slightly aggravated parliamentarians by interpreting legislation that appeared clear as not applying to D.
This was the Supreme Court.
Yes, this was the Supreme Court. The lower courts
were on point.
Yeah. So Parliament, under urgency, passed legislation to reverse the result and clarify the law. Parliament taking the step of changing the law after a court decision doesn't happen very often, but a court that is, that's because poor decisions are relatively rare. And we haven't had a Supreme Court that's deliberately taking the law on a journey or granting itself as much license as the court is now after Fitzgerald. And so if the courts see their task is to the common law method is to take the law on a journey or to develop it having regard to their views, the current judges' views of changing societal values, it can expect that that it will be overturned more often by Parliament. And that's what's happening in the Marine, or proposed to happen, in relation to the Marine and Coastal Areas Act case.
So this is where Parliament said that for an iwi to be able to claim possession, they need to have continuous...
Exclusive and continuous.
And the Supreme Court says, well, that just seems unfair.
No, it hasn't got to the Supreme Court. It's just the Court of Appeal. So
oh, was
far.
That just the Court of Appeal?
The Court of Appeal said exclusive can mean a shared exclusive, and continuous can mean interrupted.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Okay. So your solution, number one, legislate to overturn bad judgments. That is kind of forcing the courts back into their lane. A rule of law amendment to the Superior Court Acts. To define the rule of law?
Yes.
Because at the moment you don't think it's adequately defined?
No, so we've legislated that that nothing in the Supreme Court Act affects our country's continuing or our legal system's continuing commitment to the sovereignty of Parliament and the rule of law, but we haven't defined what the rule of law is. And while we know what parliamentary sovereignty means, the rule of law could do with being clarified. Does it just mean the formal requirements of laws, which is, I think, almost certainly what Parliament intended at the time, so clearly articulated, consistently applied, impartially applied, accessible, the formal qualities that laws should have, that laws in a good legal system should have, or does it include substantive elements like economic rights or concepts like decolonising, which is Justice Glazebrook has suggested in a lecture.
Poor old Justice Glazebrook. She gets some attention.
So that's the second thing. So the report sets out a narrow definition of the rule of law to act as guardrails against the courts making the big social policy decisions that are better left to Parliament under the guise of a broad view of what the rule of law means.
Amending the Legislation Act?
Yeah, so the Legislation Act is the provision I read out a moment ago, which says that laws should be... The meaning of legislation must be ascertained from its text and in the light of its purpose and context. Almost certainly, Parliament meant context. By context, Parliament, the context when the legislation was passed.
Yes.
Not, and not, and wasn't intending courts to be able to update the meaning of
phrases in the Act having regard to society's changing values. That's a job for Parliament. So the ambulatory approach, which you mentioned previously, is a bit like the living constitution approach in the US, that the meaning of the words used in the constitution changes society's values changed. I'm firmly of the view that that courts are not well suited to working out what society's values are. That's much better left to the democratic process.
Humpty Dumpty version of interpretation.
Yeah, so rather than allowing an ambulatory approach, which the courts have adopted in some contexts, legislation should be passed making clear that context means context at the time the legislation was passed. And a second amendment to the Legislation Act, it should be made to rein in Lord Hoffman's and the Supreme Court's broad view of the principle of legality, so that it can't be used to it can't be used to adopt unreasonable interpretations.
Amend the Bill of Rights or Section 6 of it anyway?
So Section 6 is the one that says courts should prefer Bill of Rights consistent interpretations where possible. There's a fair case for just axing Section 6. We've had we've had a quarter of a century for Parliament to know what the rights are in the Bill of Rights and to be careful about them. But at the very least, Parliament should make a similar amendment to Section 6 to make it clear that the courts can't there must be ambiguity and that courts can't adopt an unreasonable interpretation of Parliament's words.
And finally, and most controversially...
Yes, I don't know how controversial it is. Judicial appointment processes. So those four recommendations are more for the... Well, the first one, the earlier recommendations are more for the Minister of Justice. The last one is more for the Attorney General. And that is for the Attorney General first to pay... In making appointments to the senior court, so to the... Or to the senior appellate courts, Court of Appeal and Supreme Court.
Hopefully she's still listening.
I'm sure she is. To pay particular attention to the need for judges who show judicial restraint, who aren't wedded to this notion of taking the common law on a journey, that have respect for the rule of law and its need for certainty and predictability, which of course you don't have if the law is susceptible to judges changing changing societal values. And respect for the sovereignty of Parliament. So that's just when selecting judges, those are key attributes that you should bear in mind. And secondly, and perhaps more controversially, although there's plenty of examples of it around the world, term limits for judges to the Supreme Court. And so my suggestion there is that judges get promoted from the Court of Appeal for, say, 5 to 7 years to the Supreme Court, and then after their 5 to 7 years, they go back to the Court of Appeal. Supreme Court, as I say, it decides 20 cases a year. The Court of Appeal decides hundreds, dealing with a great array of legal issues. It will keep the Supreme Court judges more grounded in the nitty-gritty of the law than the rarefied ears they're used to in the Supreme Court.
Because that is the inference that you are creating there, that you are creating the impression that the Supreme Court judges are somewhat cloistered into their world, little world with perhaps an elevated view of their status? Am I being too harsh?
The risk is that they are... that they're not grounded enough, and judicial terms is one solution to that. Another is simply to have the Supreme Court drawn by lot from judges of the Court of Appeal who weren't involved in the cases below, and so you could just convene a panel of Court of Appeal judges to act as the Supreme Court.
Well, because it has been my experience over many decades that you will sometimes get a bad decision because an individual judge acting on their own can get lost in their own thoughts. But when you have three judges, there's a process of internal checking that's been my experience. It almost doesn't matter the calibre of the judges, that's a little bit harsh, but just having multiple people thinking about the issue, you're more likely to get a reasonable result. The other thing I've noticed, and people have had me up about, including my own in-house lawyers, who say, "Oh, you shouldn't criticise the judiciary," and I've had senior lawyers make that point to me. But I think that's wrong, and I think that is disrespectful to the judiciary itself, because it creates the impression that the judiciary is sensitive to, or they may or may not be sensitive to criticism, but it creates it in the minds of people who say that. I think they think that the judges will punish them or their clients because they speak out. And I don't think that's true. I've got more respect for the judiciary than that.
Well, yes, and it's critical to our three branches of government that all are subject to critique.
Mm.
Now, that critique should be measured. A very senior political editor described my report as quite as reasonable and gentle, and I'm if that's the tone, then that's good, because it wants to be reasoned. I'm passionately in favour of protecting and preserving an impartial judiciary.
Mm.
I think it's a great hallmark of a legal system that the ordinary person doesn't know the names of judges.
Yes.
I've referred to judges only by name in relation to particular decisions, which is common for academic journals because you've got to refer to whose judgment it was you're critiquing. But this shouldn't be, this critique is not, or my critique is not personal to the identities or the individual identities of particular judges. It's about the way the court is operating and the jurisprudential approach it has adopted, both to interpreting Acts of Parliament and its approach to what it calls developing the common law.
And there is a coherent intellectual argument out on the other side. I'm pretty comfortable heading in this direction. We'll see how my cases go going forward. Roger, I really enjoyed. So I drew heavily both on your New Zealand Initiative publication, Who Makes Law, Reigning in the Supreme Court, by Roger Patridge. But also, as a result of that, I found Jack Hodder KC's speech, or not speech, publication, One Advocate's Opinions, The Least Dangerous Branch, Predictability and Unease, which is about 30 pages, and that's a really useful read if people want to know more. Roger,
thank you
for coming on.
Damien, it's been a pleasure.
Cheers.